This is KBOO. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. This was Digging Roots, Bring the Water. We are now going to turn on this Thanksgiving morning. Thank you all for tuning in for this special Indigenous Voices on a Colonial Holiday. We are now going to talk to a talk by Winona LaDuke for Portland State of Mind Campus Sustainability Day that was recorded on Wednesday, October 22nd at PSU. This is a keynote address by Winona LaDuke on Indigenous perspective and grassroots strategies for mitigating climate change. LaDuke is a member of the Mississippi Band of the White Earth Reservation of the Anishinaabe Nation. She's an activist, economic, environmentalist, two-time vice presidential candidate and author. Among other impressive endeavors, she is currently the executive director for the White Earthland Recovery Project, which she founded in 89. And she is often called upon to discuss traditional native methods of food production and sustainable land management, as well as experiences bringing those skills back to the White Earth Reservation. And so in this recording, Winona LaDuke talks about food sovereignty, what she is doing and her community is doing on the White Earth Reservation to increase the tribe's self-sustaining practices. She's also discussing the connections between food, climate change, and energy dependence.
Anin Nindaway Maganaduk, Nigagwege Demagas. Miigwech, thank you so much for having me here tonight and for that really gracious and generous introduction. So, this month in our language is called Banakwe Ogizis, which is the leaves falling moon. The moon that follows this Banakwe Ogizis is Gashkadn Ogizis, which is the freezing over moon. Then you have Manitou Gizisoons, which is the little spirit moon. Gishi Manitou Gizis, which is the great spirit moon. Then you have a moon that is known as Namay Bene Gizis, which is also known as the sucker moon. Suckers kind of fish in our territory. And then you have Ona Bana Gizis. That moon is known as the hard-crusted snow moon around March in my territory. That's when it snows and it thaws and it freezes again, yeah? Also known as the moon you do not want to do a face plant in the snow. And then we have Iskigamizigigizis, which is our maple syruping moon. That's the moon that follows that. Wabaganagizis, that's our flower moon. Odeimenagizis, strawberry moon. Meangizis, our blueberry moon. Manomenakegizis. Manomenakegizis, that's our wild rice-making moon, what you've seen on our lakes. And then we have Watibagagizis. That's the one we just finished here, and that's when the leaves change color. So I thought that you might like to hear some of our Anishinaabe Mohan, our language. You might like to hear that language. And I also, you know, wanted you to listen to that because those are moons, and that is a sense of time that is named after a land. That's what that is. And I think you probably noticed, but I just want to make sure you notice that none of those moons is named after a Roman emperor. Not a single one. There's no Julius Caesar in there anywhere. So I want to say that because it is possible to have an entire worldview that has nothing to do with empire. And you'll be okay. You'll be okay. And so to me, that is part of what I think that it is time to think about, is moving beyond empire. Because empire is about conquest. Empire is about subjugation. Empire is about having a predator economy that takes everything and leaves nothing. Empire is not sustainable. We have to transition from the thinking, the worldview, and we all, except for those homeschool kids over there, we all went to these schools. We had it shoved down our throats. We all drank the Kool-Aid of the dominant paradigm. Question is if you can liberate yourself from that thinking. You know, and I'm saying that it is time to rethink. It is time to rethink. And you have to kind of have a little courage. You know, but I think about that because we are people that are accustomed to that. And what we know, you know, I think that James Hightower might have said it best, a former Texas Agriculture Commission. He says, if you're digging a hole, you know, at a certain point, you better just quit digging. And that's kind of where we're at. We're digging ourselves a pretty deep hole. And you might want to just quit digging, you know, and figure out what's going on out there. We're at this moment where in our teachings as Anishinaabe people, you got a choice between two paths. We were told you have a choice between two mikina in the time of the seventh fire. And one path, they said, was well-worn, but it was scorched. The second path they saw it said was not well-worn, and it was green. And it was our choice upon which path to embark. That's what prophets told our people, you know, maybe 2,000 years ago. And that's the time we're in. And I know that that is what they said it was Anishinaabe, but I'm pretty sure that that's where we all are. We live in this time where you got to make a choice. Or as we say in our work at home, love water, not oil. You know, because you got a choice between the two, and one of them you can live without. But one of them you cannot, you know. So let us talk about this and a little bit of where we are at in this. This is some art from my community. I just have to show you this art. And I don't know how many of you have seen this kind of art before. Can you raise your hands? Just my little sociology programming here. Okay, survey. So this is Anishinaabe art. It's acrylic painting. It's adapted from what would be like in the boundary waters and pictographs and in birch bark scrolls. It comes from our teachings. But what you see inside this art is you see spirit beings and you see spirit lines that connect those beings. And I say that because we have this teaching of Ndinawe Muganatuk, which means we are all related. We are all related, and it's reflected in that art. And, you know, it's all true. We're all like 99.9% the same, which I know really bummed out the white supremacists. But, you know, we're all really, really tight, basically. We're different, and we're beautiful in our diversity. But that is part of the teaching of that. And I always like to show this art because when I was an undergraduate at Harvard, if you wanted to study the art from Europe, you went to the fine arts department. And if you wanted to study the art from indigenous communities, you went to anthropology. And that says a lot about the valuation of knowledge in an American education. And what I'm saying is that part of where we are at is that it is time to let go of that stuff. Because that Eurocentric thought system, which values some of the things that came out of there, does not value that. And I think that, you know, that those teachings are also valid. This is a little bit about who we are in our community and our way of life, which is a cyclical system. And I say that because in a land-based economy, it is cyclical. The tides, the moons, the seasons, and how you live your life, the months themselves are viewed as cyclical. The economy that we live in the United States is not a cyclical economy. It is actually a linear economy. It is predicated largely on the extraction, continuous extraction of resources, the adding of labor to them and a bunch of money and the making of stuff. And then that stuff, you know, 13 trillion tons of it ends up, 13 trillion pounds of it ends up as garbage every year, right? As waste. And then they have the waste water thing. And I haven't figured out how you can actually have waste water. You know what I'm saying? But the fracking industry is creating a lot of wastewater. As you may know, they remove it entirely from the hydrological cycle. And so what I'm saying is that's an example of a linear economy. That is nothing that is going to return and make good. That is something that is linear, and that is an unsustainable system. That is the physical manifestation of it in an economy, but there is also a social manifestation of that. And the United States is a very good example of the social manifestation of the creation of garbage, and that is the prison industrial complex. On a worldwide scale, there's about 9 million prisoners in the world and 2.2 million of them are in the United States. If you want a growth economy in some of your small towns or villages, or if you want to be Grants, New Mexico, that used to be the carrot capital of New Mexico, then became the uranium capital of New Mexico and is now the prison capital of New Mexico. That's a linear economy. Because you do not want to be about the social production of waste and the creation of waste people. It is not sustainable. And so that's what I'm saying, is that part of the deconstruction and the challenge of where we are and where we need to go means that you have to look really at the whole paradigm. It is not just one thing. It is the entire paradigm. Because that is how we got in this, is in this perception. So in my village, or a village near us, Keweenaw Bay, that's actually over on the east side of Superior, they sold in 1 year 453,000 pounds of maple sugar. That was when they had all those trees and they still got a lot of them. That is a land-based economy. You can harvest your maple syrup every year, or you can cut your trees. Two differences in how you live your life, you know? And I'm saying that there is a way. I don't know, that we're trying to figure out the street value of that in this day and age. It's like 10 bucks a pound for that maple sugar, you know what I'm saying? And that's one village, that's 4 million pounds, that comes at 4 million bucks at least, you know, that could come out of that village. So this is your ocean on acid. And this is what we are dealing with. So all of you who are eating all the beautiful food that we are eating, the more CO2 that we pump into the environment, the more we kill our oceans. And so I say that because this is like the relationship between food security and climate change. This is a huge problem that we are facing that we need to obviously address. This is the food economy. This is my reservation. What I'll tell you is that my tribe, totally self-sufficient. You know, as you know, for those who are non-native, your ancestors brought neither land or food to this country. Let's just be honest about that. We had it all, right? And they were hungry and skinny and had scurvy and stuff. That's really an oversimplification of history, but it's true. And so we ate well. Man, those Blackfeet are still tall Indians, that's all I know. So those Indians on the northern plains were like 7 feet tall. The ancestors from Europe were like 4'10". I'm just trying to say, look, things were good. We fed ourselves well, a lot of salmon everywhere, we ate good. So now my tribe, we've become people who, we still have a pretty strong subsistence economy. My house is about 50% subsistence. Maybe a little more. We don't want to get into the details of that harvesting, but it's pretty substantial. But what I will say is that increasingly, my tribe has become people who are dependent. And so in my community, we increasingly buy more food. And so we spend a quarter of our economy on food in my tribe. We surveyed 10% of the reservation. We asked what they do, where they shop, and it turns out that of our 8 million bucks that households spent in the year, about 7 million was spent off reservation almost immediately. Walmart, Food Service of America, bringing it into our tribal programs, right? Our tribal schools, everything like that. And the $1 million that was spent on reservation was spent almost entirely at convenience stores buying junk food, right? And that is how you get a third of your people that have diabetes. Is that transition forced? And then, you know, your colonialism policies, you know, you end up with that. So this is my community, and this is what we're doing there. We are interested in corn, and a lot of people have heard me say this, but my father, he passed away about 20 years ago. He is a pretty cool old dude from White Earth. And he used to say to me, he'd come see me when I was out east at school, and he'd say, Winona, you're a really smart young woman, but I don't want to hear your philosophy if you can't grow corn. And he was right. You know, it's great to be smart, but if you cannot feed yourself and you cannot think, you know, then what have you done? And that is in part the challenge that a lot of people face now, is we've become really smart people that don't do anything. You know, we live in an economy that is the equivalent of about 100 slaves per household. Our heat, our food, our clothing is brought to us by someone else, right? That is how we are living, and that is not sustainable. Most of those agreements were not fair trade agreements, as you know. The relationships are not fair trade when you're getting your power from dams that destroy salmon and villages, right? Nothing is fair about what is going on in our opulence of our fossil fuels lifestyle. And so it is that I decided to grow corn. It took me about 15 years before I became smart enough to grow corn. And so I grow basically my one corn variety that I grow two corn varieties, but one is known as Bear Island Flint. We have fields of this corn now. I've never had a crop failure. It is multicolored Flint corn. It has twice the protein and half the calories of sweet corn. It grows well in our soil. When I first grew it, I thought I had failed because it was so short. But it turns out it does not need to be tall corn to be great corn. And in the case of our region, it came from an island in the middle of Leech Lake, and in the case of our region, it turns out that that corn, when it's frost-resistant and it's drought-resistant, and when the big winds came through, they blew over Monsanto's fields, but my field stood. So I say that because in a time of climate change, you might want to grow something that's going to hang out, not something that's going to be like really like need a lot of help. The second corn variety that's shown in the picture, which is now not this picture, is Pink Lady corn. It's magenta pink flower corn. My friend Sue Wicca is growing it. And the reason I show you that is because it's cool corn. People say, why do you grow it? I said, because it's pink. Someone said to me, why don't you grow blue corn? I said, why don't you grow blue corn? It's like 8,000 varieties. Grow whatever color you want, you know? And saying, you know, so we Anishinaabe people are the northernmost corn growers in the world. We push corn 100 miles north of Winnipeg. And so what I'm saying is I'm interested in growing climate change, adapted, resilient corn varieties that are going to feed my people. That's what I'm interested in. I do like pink. That's what I did. That last picture is a picture of what's known as Pawnee Eagle corn. If you can see it closely, it is there's eagles on it. And just, you know, I went and I asked Deb Echohawk if I could tell this story because that came from her. But this is the story I'm going to tell you. And it's important to remember because it links corn and our peoples. So the Pawnees were once the Arikara people, and they lived in the northern Missouri River, the place that is now known as the Fort Berthold Reservation, the northern agricultural empire on the Missouri River, kind of like the Nile Delta of North America. And I think it's really important to think about that because the trade routes were so substantial in the north from around that territory. And those people grew really a wide variety of vegetables and foods. And so it is there that they came to from their story. They descended from the sky. And when they descended from the sky, what I was told is that the man came down in a buffalo robe and the woman came down in a corn husk. And I say that because this is something about how food is not just something you get at the store. Food is something that comes from the Creator, and it is a part of who we are as peoples. So they grew those varieties, and they lived well, and that at a certain point, they decide that they are going to leave, and they move south, and they became the Pawnees. They split off. And when they lived down there in Nebraska, they lived well. And the way it was told to me was that they did pretty good, and the settlers came, and they still got on pretty good with the settlers. And when they was with the settlers, they would trade, and what Deb Echohawk told me was that she said, we were kind of like AAA. If your horse was lame, you go see the Pawnees, you know? If you need something fixed, they go work back and forth, you know? And I want to say that because people can have good relationships with people that are settlers that come in. It is the nature of, you know, how the relationship is formed. And so then what happened is that the federal government came in and messed stuff up. And when the federal government came in and messed stuff up, they forced those people to move in three separate forced removals to Oklahoma. And in that, those people lost a great deal. They lost their people, they lost their land, they lost the place of their ancestors, and then they also lost a lot of their foods because their foods would not grow in Oklahoma. And so they grieved, and that historical grief that our people have, and trauma. And so it took many years, and they kept losing their seeds. And then one day, this woman named Ronnie O'Brien from the Archway Museum in Kearney, Nebraska, called down to the Pawnee Tribal Council and said, I am in your homeland, and I'd like to try to grow some traditional seeds for the Pawnees. That's what she said. And they said, you have to talk to Deb Echohawk. And so I met both these women, and they told me this story. And so Deb said that she called, and she said, I don't know what to do. She said, we don't have a lot of seeds, because they had very few left. And so she said she talked to their elders committee, and the elders committee deliberated long and hard, and then they said, you know, we're going to send some of those seeds back to our homeland. And so the descendants of the settlers in the Pawnee homeland grew the seeds of the Pawnees in their old territory. And what Deb told me was that the seeds remembered the land they came from. And so the seeds flourished. And so the recovery of a lot of the Pawnee seeds was by bringing them back to the Pawnee homeland. And in that process, this relationship developed. And about 4 years ago, they had Welcome Home Pawnee Days in Kearney, Nebraska. And 150 Pawnees came up on buses, and 8,000 people came out to see them. And so I tell you that story for a couple of reasons. One is because it is a story of corn. And corn, one of the greatest foods in the world, did not exist in nature. It only exists because of humans. It began as teosinte, and it was adapted, and with the love and attention of humans, corn came to be in all its glory and all its varieties. And so we are not bad. We can do great things if we do them well. And the second thing I like, the reason I tell that story is I like to think, I think of it as a story of redemption, that you can go and help fix things many generations later. And I think it is always possible. And this is me teaching corn braiding to a bunch of kids in the Pine Point Elementary School as a part of our farm to school program a couple of years ago. I think about an hour later, I fell asleep on the desk. I was so tired because I taught corn braiding to like 50 kids. And I was like, this is our cool squashes, Aricara squash and Gete Okosamen, really high in vitamins, magnesium, minerals, antioxidants, just rocking and all of that. This one large squash here came, the story I was told is it came out of an archaeological dig near the town of Green Bay, Wisconsin. And they were digging down there and they found a clay ball that was about this big. And they shook that ball and there's something in it, and they crack it open, and there was those seeds, and they grew those seeds out. Those seeds were carbon dated 800 years old. And that's that squash. And then I was told it was 1,000 years old, so I don't know. It is one old squash. And then people said, what do you call that squash, Winona? What do you call that squash? Because the guy who gave it to me was the guy who grew it, and it had been given to him. And I said, I don't know what you call that squash. And nobody knew. I said, well, I'm going to name that squash because white guys name stuff all the time. And so I named that squash Gete Okosamen, which in Anishinaabe Mohan or in our language means really cool old squash. That's our squash. If you want the solution, you know what the solution is you relocalize your food economy and you relocalize your energy economy. You control the seeds and you plant good food. And then this is my solution, industrial hemp. If you have an oil spill with industrial hemp and you just fertilize your soil, I'm working on getting my tribe to adopt an industrial hemp ordinance and grow it this year. It is also really good for bioremediation. And I heard about this stuff, you guys all know more about this because you're Oregon, but Charlotte's Web, right? Which is hemp, as opposed to marijuana, has no THC in it. And it's highly medicinal. It's good for fibromyalgia, which a lot of our women in our community have. You have this opportunity to make history now. We have this opportunity to change the course of stupidity. You know, that is the opportunity that we are in right now. And that opportunity, much of it is predicated on regaining control of ourselves, of where our food comes from and where our energy comes from. And in that process of transitioning, you are able to transform your economy. I really like this quote. I'm almost at the end, but I opened up this book, Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation, on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. The Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation came out of the spiritual vision of Native people there in that community. They're Sundowns, Thunder Valley. And they decided they want to build an intentional community, which was what they wanted it to look like. And what they said in their report that I was reviewing, this quote came out, which is, how long are you going to let others determine the future for your children? Are we not warriors? When your ancestors went off into battle, they did not know what the consequences were going to be. All they knew is that if they did nothing, that it would not work out well for them. Do not operate out of a place of fear. Operate out of a place of hope. Because with hope, anything is possible. Time is now. I went to this conference of economics, because I'm an economist actually by training. So 43 countries are hanging out and talking about indexing, because the United States indexes its economy on GNP. You know, we talk about production, we talk about unemployment, but we don't talk about quality of life. And so a number of countries in the world are indexing based on what is known as happiness, the happiness indexing, right? Because it turns out that shopping more, drinking, you know, taking more drugs, having more prisons, having more guns, doesn't actually make you happy. The United States is not a particularly happy country. You know, as rich as we are, our high levels of consumption, we're not a happy bunch. The happiest country in the world for many years is this country, Vanuatu, right? I told you they're a Melanesian island, 85% local. They checked out what they want, their people wanted. Their people said, we want access to our natural world. They want security. They want good food to eat. They want long-term emotional family security. When they're old, they don't want to be shuffled away. They wanted health care. They wanted education. You know, that's what they wanted, which I think is actually what we all want. You know, that is actually a lot of what we all want. We want quality of life, which is based on those quality issues. And so, you know, I was, privileged to hang out with these, you know, people. I was hanging out. One day I was between Bhutan, and who has a gross national happiness index, and Vanuatu. I was like, man, this is a happy moment. You know, but the point was, so then I'm hanging out with them, and a few years ago, Vanuatu got thrown off. They were no longer the happiest country in the world. And they got ousted by Costa Rica. I don't know if you remember this, but I was like, and Costa Rica does not even have a military, right? But they won the Happy Planet Award. And I said, what happened, Vanuatu? What happened to your award? And they said, faulty data. So they're doing all their studies and trying to get back their crown or whatever. But I said, look, I'm gonna go home, I'm gonna throw the gauntlet down, and we're going to win the Happy Planet Award. It might take us a few years to decolonize ourselves and get rid of our historic trauma. We're going to be really happy. That's us and our organization. Miigwech, thank you very much for your time.
And that was Winona LaDuc speaking at Portland State University at the State of Mind Campus Sustainability Day, recorded on Wednesday, October 22nd of this year at Portland State University, speaking on Indigenous perspectives and grassroots strategies for mitigating climate change.